Thank you, Anya. And thank you. First of all, I want to repeat my earlier thank you to you and your team at classicalwisdom.com for putting this event together. I know that it takes an insane amount of work to bring, you know, to find such great speakers, to organize this, and to attract an incredible audience as you've done. So great job on that. And I am now excited to begin the keynote event of today. For those of you who've been with us since the morning, thank you also for, you know, being with us. I know that if you're like me, you're probably feeling a combination of excited about the ideas you've heard, but also getting a little bit tired. But this next event, I think it's fair to say we will end today with a bang. Not the kind of bang that brings down a civilization, but the kind of bang that discusses what that might be like. With us, so the topic under discussion is, do states and empires die in different ways? And what can their deaths teach us today? And with us here to discuss are three world-renowned scholars. Neil Ferguson, whom you heard speak earlier today, is the Milbank Family Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. And besides being a prolific scholar and author, he's also an award-winning filmmaker. And his new book is called Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe. Angie Hobbs, whom you also heard earlier, is professor of the public understanding of philosophy at the University of Sheffield in England, and is one of the most well-known communicators of ancient philosophy in our time. There's a good chance you've seen her on any number of documentaries, television, and radio programs explaining the most abstruse philosophical concepts in a way that any curious person can understand. And finally, I'd like to welcome a new speaker to the symposium whom we have not yet heard. James Hankins is an intellectual historian specializing in the Italian Renaissance. He is a professor in the history department at Harvard University. He's the co-founder and general editor of the Itati Renaissance Library, which is a hugely impressive multi-volume series of editions that takes the great intellectual works of the Italian Renaissance that were written in Latin and makes them accessible to a broad modern audience as bilingual editions with Latin on the one side and English on the other. His most recent book is Virtue Politics, Soulcraft and Statecraft in Renaissance Italy. Now, I expect this discussion will be vibrant and full of diverse ideas and perspectives. I'm sure that by the end, we will likely have tons of questions that we could go on for many more sessions. And I also expect a flood of questions from the audience as the conversation progresses. So in order to make sure that we move along as swiftly as possible and maintain a conversational, system here, I'm going to ask the speakers to be as brief as possible in all their answers. Think of it like that challenge in soccer or football for the British, where you got to pass the ball as fast as possible. That way we can keep it vibrant. And if anyone goes over 2 minutes, I will be jumping in to gently encourage you to bring your point home so we can move on. So first, I'd like to ask just really quickly, just so the audience can get a sense of who you guys are and, you know, what you work on, I'd like to ask you to just say quickly, what specific period of history have you been focused on recently, perhaps in the run-up to today's conference, and why is that particular period of history interesting for thinking of the end of empires and the fall of nations? So Angie, let me start with you. What's your answer for that?
Okay, in under 2 minutes, three areas. So I've been working on Plato, as I usually do. So that's got me to think both about his account of the rise and fall of ideal states and the different kinds of degenerate state, degeneration of democracy into tyranny, and his implicit critiques of contemporary Athens and Athenian imperialism, which has also led me into Thucydides and Euripides and their oblique critiques of Athenian imperialism. With great debt to Professor Hankins, I've been dipping my toe in the Renaissance in the last few years, writing on both Ficino and Moore and their relationship with ancient Greek thought. And again, that's got me thinking about the fall of Constantinople in 1453 and how that allowed both Greek scholars who knew and studied the ancient Greek language, they had to emigrate to Western Europe, and they brought the knowledge of ancient Greek to Italy, taught Ficino, and as we all know, Ficino kicks off really the Platonic Renaissance in the West. And finally, I've been writing on World War I and on classical notions of heroism in World War I and the relationship between classics and World War I. That's obviously got me thinking about the decay of empires in Western Europe and the rise of the Soviet Empire, but it's also got me looking at the Roman Empire in a new way via Horace.
All right, fascinating, Angie, thank you. And James, if I may, tell us a bit about what period of history you've been thinking about recently and how that informs your perspective on the topic at hand.
Well, I've been writing a new history of Western civilization from the Greeks to the present time. So that's going to be covering the waterfront, but I normally hang out in the late medieval Renaissance, early modern period, where there's a great deal of crashing civilizations. The civilization of Christendom in the Middle Ages also collapses in this period, which is an ideological construct, an imaginary empire in a way. And it, I think, has many analogies to the kind of ideological collapses going on around us in the world. I just finished a book on the greatest political theorist of the 15th century, someone no one's ever heard of. His name is Francesco Patrizi of Siena, but I'm billing him as the un-Machiavelli. And aside from that, I'm just I'm writing my usual columns, trying to stave off the collapse of civilization, or at least protest as civilization declines.
Great, thank you, James. And finally, to Neil, what have you been focused on recently? I know your book is Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe. So tell us a bit about your recent area of focus.
Well, first of all, it's a pleasure to be on a panel with two former colleagues and friends. And I think this is a happy combination. I have done two high altitude survey type books in the last few years. Doom is in some ways a sequel to The Square and the Tower, which was a book about networks and contagion. These two books are in some ways a distraction from a very different kind of project, a biography, which I'm in the midst of writing, of Henry Kissinger. So although the two most recent books cover a very large sweep of history and indeed attempt to include ancient history, about which, as I confessed earlier, I'm no expert, the real focus of my interest as a kind of traditional historian who reads documents and tries to reconstruct the past that way is the 1970s. So I'm somebody who likes to kind of zoom in periodically and to focus on a particular individual or particular period. But I don't think one can do that well without the broader perspective. The reason I started writing a book on networks and hierarchies was that I felt I had to locate Kissinger's life in that strange transition that happens in the mid-20th century from a world of very hierarchical organizational structures, of org charts, to a world of networks, which in some ways was a transition he personified. And in the same way, I didn't think I could really write about the calamitous outcome of the American involvement in Indochina without having a general history of disaster to put it in some kind of broad perspective. Needless to say, recent events confirm an argument I made nearly 20 years ago about the nature of American empire. I was just flicking through my book Colossus, which I published before I became Jim's colleague at Harvard, and pretty much all that is playing out here was foreseen in that book. And that doesn't make me a Nostradamus. It was just pretty obvious that the American interventions in Iraq and Afghanistan would end in this kind of familiar 1975-ish kind of way. I was interested in Jim's reference to Western civilization. It's brave of you to write a book defending it, almost an invitation to be cancelled, a little bit like writing a book that said the British Empire was on balance a good thing, which these days will get you unpublished if you make the argument in the wrong journal. I wrote a book called Civilization 10 years ago. I still think that a crucial contribution we can make as historians is to try to revive in the universities the study of Western civilization, and not only Western civilization, of civilizations, and try to broaden the scope and maybe toughen the rigor of a lot that gets taught in history departments. So I think that's a reasonable summary of what I'm up to.
Great. Thank you, Neil. So as our audience can see, I think we have an amazing panorama of historical perspectives here from Angie Hobbs in Greco-Roman antiquity, and James Hankins, mainly rooted in the Italian Renaissance, and Neil Ferguson, who has a more global modern perspective. And just to maybe tell you guys where I'm coming from, because in my excitement about this topic and this panel, I forgot to introduce myself. I'm Jack Vishnick, and I'm an ancient philosopher. I've worked a lot on Plato and the Stoics. And I also worked for an institute that seeks to uncover historical patterns. So hence my great interest in this topic and my excitement to hear your perspective. So here's a quick fun exercise. We all know, you all know the famous quote by the great British historian Arnold Toynbee, that civilizations do not, they die from suicide, not by murder. So I'd like to just ask the three of you quickly to say, on a scale from 1 to 10, where 1 means it's nonsense and 10 means it's the absolute truth, how would you rate that statement, and maybe just give one or two reasons why? So maybe let's flip the order this time. Neil, what's your take on Toynbee's aphorism?
Well, it's a 5, because it's easy to think of civilizations that did commit suicide in the sense that their internal failures were fatal. But it's equally easy to think of civilizations that were murdered. I mean, think of the civilizations of South and Central America, which were essentially destroyed by the pathogens introduced by Europeans. And one can hardly blame the Aztecs and Incas for their population's lack of resistance to a variety of microbes from Europe.
All right, that's a fair answer. James, what's your take on it?
I also said 5. It's half true, or rather it's a false dichotomy. They die from both, obviously. I think Toynbee's being too metaphorical here. I have to confess I didn't go back and read the passage in which he said this, but it's not clear what suicide means, what murder means in practical terms. The Roman historians are much more concrete. The Roman historians who talk about the fall of Rome, and as we know, they start talking about the fall of Rome about 500 years before it actually does fall. Sallust, for example, says it's luxury. The Romans have too much success. They've gotten wealthy. They have no enemies, and so they're fighting each other. The whole country's falling apart from factionalism and warring hegemons, warlords. Basically, the normal ancient explanation you find actually in the Renaissance way up to modern times is moral corruption. I think there's a lot to be said for the moral corruption explanation. It's the higher naivete, as Donald Kagan used to say. That is to say, it seems like a naive explanation. And modern historians, with all of their social science explanations, would have different, you know, much more technically rich descriptions of how empires fall. But actually, I think moral explanations count for a lot. And especially, I've been focusing lately on the function of elites in the fall of civilizations and their failure to command the respect of the commons. Use that term for non-elites.
So that's interesting that you are by focusing on the elites there and their failures, you're kind of taking a more Toynbee-esque approach, whereas I think Neil Ferguson in his recent book focuses on how middle management can also fail and be a cause for a lot of problems. And I want to get to those issues. But Angie, what's your take on the suicide versus murder question? How do civilizations fall?
I'm sorry to be your nightmare, but it has to be a five. Because if take states and take empires, I mean, if you look at them individually, it's nearly always a mixture, you know, of three factors. You've got the environmental catastrophes and plagues. They're all interlinked, of course. You've got wars and external pressures, and then you've got various groups of moral, intellectual, and competency failings, both at leadership levels and middle management levels. And they all interconnect, because moral failings can make people more prone to attack from external aggressors, and can in some cases bring on environmental catastrophes. Of course, they all interconnect, and you just have to go through each, you know, and you kind of say, well, yeah, Pompeii, that was just sort of exploded. Athens and Sparta, much more complicated. What I would say, though, is that if you make a distinction between states and empires, it's more often the case that a state or a city can be just destroyed. Helike in the northern Peloponnese was just destroyed by a kind of earthquake, and I think then tsunami in 373 BCE. Pompeii, obviously, we know about Troy. Certainly something very bad happened to that level of Troy in about 1190. Knossos, it wasn't finally it didn't finally die, but hugely damaged by the eruption of Thera, which I think, 1624, about then. Empires tend to be more prone to the moral failings that James has just been discussing, because one thing that nearly every empire has in common is that there is an element of autocracy somewhere, an authoritarianism. Even if they're like the Persian Empire and they're built on this ideology of that states have voluntarily agreed to be part of the empire, in practice, there's nearly always different layers of authoritarianism and autocracy. And what we know from history is that though authoritarianism, of course, looks very strong, that's the whole point of it, it's actually fundamentally very brittle. It's very rigid and it's very brittle, and it can snap. And so you get situations more often with empires. We all know the quote from Hemingway's, "The sun also rises," when a character is asked how he became bankrupt. And he says, in two ways, gradually, then suddenly. And so you get this sort of long period of decay, as with the Roman Empire, you know, at least two, three centuries of mostly terrible emperors in the third, fourth and fifth centuries, common era, you know, a few exceptions like Diocletian, but on the whole, incompetent, weak and violent and useless emperors. And it's sort of decaying and decaying, becoming more and more factionalized. Pagans and Christians in the West can't agree on a common narrative. And then, you know, plagues, as Professor, you know, Neil was talking about earlier, and then you just get the what looks like a kind of implosion, but actually it's been building up for a long, long time.
Maybe I can add one thing, Jack, which
absolutely, yeah,
which illustrates why five is the right score. I mean, at the time Toynbee was writing and thinking about this, there are these totalitarian empires that have relatively short durations by historic standards. The Third Reich's especially short-lived, but it had to be destroyed with tremendous violence from without. Despite the fact that it was an entirely odious and corrupt and dysfunctional regime within. By contrast, the Soviet Union did not need to be destroyed from without, unless you count the arms race that tipped it over into insolvency. In truth, the Soviet Union rotted from within. And that's, to me, a perfect illustration of the problem with the Toynbee hypothesis. I think you had to kill the Third Reich, but the Soviet Union drank itself to death, basically.
All right. So thanks for that. And, you know, I'm glad, Angie, that you reminded us of the distinction between states and empires, because we should probably clarify that distinction since it is in the title. And maybe I'll just say a few words about how this topic was formulated by Anya, the organizer, and myself. And we were, you know, we noted the fact that for the past, I don't know, many decades, when people talk about collapse, civilizational collapse, they almost always talk of the fall of great empires, you know, the fall of Rome, the fall of Constantinople, the fall of any number of great Chinese dynasties, et cetera. And it's only recently in the past 5 or 10 years or so that people have been interested in the fall of democracies, in the fall of republics and such states. So that's the kind of dichotomy we're looking at. And it's not a black and white dichotomy, because you have imperialistic republics and you have imperialistic democracies like Rome and Athens. And you have some states that are hard to categorize, like the British Empire. In some sense, it's an oligarchy, so it's a constitutional state in some sense, I mean, in the Aristotelian sense, and in some sense, it's an empire. So, but setting aside the difficulties of the dichotomy, let's just kind of take these two paradigms, right? On the one hand, you have what we might call constitutional states, where there is the rule of law, no single individual is above the law, and there is some method of transferring power between individuals at regular intervals, and the people have at least some participatory power in that system. And on the other hand, you have, you know, a monarchic structure where one individual is above the law, that person's decrees are the law, and you have some kind of system, or at least custom of succession, and there's like a throne and there's somebody sitting on the throne. And the question is, do these two paradigms, do these types of state have unique challenges that the other type does not have? And does that result in a different kind of death? And earlier, James talked about how Sallust was bemoaning the fall of Rome 400 something years before Rome fell. But if we make this distinction of the Roman Republic, well, that did fall within a couple of decades of Sallust saying that. But when it fell, it didn't just die. It became something totally different. It became an empire with a throne. So just kind of with that clarification of the paradigms that we're talking about, I'd like to do another sweep of history and start with Angie in the ancient world, where you have 1,500 city-states that are Greek, and many more that are Italic, Etruscan, Phoenician, and a lot of them are what we would call constitutional states. They don't have a king, and they have the rule of law, and they have some kind of senate and, you know, consuls or archons or whatever, right? So in this vast ecosystem of ancient city-states, what were the unique challenges that brought, or what were the main challenges that posed existential threats to those ancient polities?
Okay, so right. So if we look at Athens, the time of its greatest ascendancy culturally, philosophically, and so on, and maybe in the age of Pericles, in the middle and the latter, the middle of the 5th century BCE, it's also the time when it's sowing the seeds of its own destruction. So it's a state, but it's growing this empire under the guise of the Delian League, which was formed to protect Greece from a further Persian incursion. But the Delian League very quickly becomes an Athenian empire, particularly when the treasury is moved from the island of Delos to Athens in, I think, 453 BCE. But, you know, the usual excuse, we're doing it to protect the money from thieves. But they're kind of making themselves center, making a lot of enemies. A lot of the islands don't sign up to this. The islands that don't sign up to this are treated very, very brutally, like Milos in 415, where all the male citizens were put to death and the women were enslaved. So it's overreach for Athens, it's arrogance, it's hubris. But just as we were saying right now, it's also being, of course, attacked by Sparta from 431 onwards, from 430 onwards, it's got a plague. So it's got all these factors rolled into one. But fundamentally, and this is certainly the point that Thucydides and Plato make, it's fundamentally moral failings with Athens and its overreach and making too many enemies. Sparta's an interesting case. So they probably reach their peak of power when they defeat Athens in 404. And it's at the very end of the 5th century, in the early 4th century, they're at the peak of their power. But again, they're sowing the seeds for their own decline because they have this demented notion of ethnic purity. And it's so difficult to be a Spartan citizen unless, you know, you have to have really rigid sort of Spartan heritage. And they just start to die out, particularly as they're such a militaristic culture. So a lot of the young guys are just getting killed before they can go and make little Spartan babies. So that's not helping them. They also, though they have had the Persians on their side and they've been trying to get Persian help, they start to annoy the Persians, and that's bad news for them. So again, a bit of hubris, a bit of overreach, and the racial kind of purity. And also, as Plato points out obliquely, they, though they have all the rhetoric of honor, you know, a culture of war, of military honor and so on, in practice they're becoming more and more corrupt. So they, yes, you know, both Athens and Sparta are making themselves very vulnerable to be overrun by the Macedonian armies of Philip of Macedon and Alexander the Great. So yeah, there are a few things.
Can I just jump in really quick and ask, you know, these are excellent points, and especially moral decline is something that we can observe not just in polis or republics and democracies, but also in empires. I mean, how many books were written on the decline of the virtue of the Persians, for example? So I'm wondering, is there anything that that the polis and, you know, early Rome, is there any kind of problem that was endemic to the kind of democratic or republican system that empires didn't have to deal with?
Plato's makes the point very clearly in the Republic that democracies can vote themselves out of existence. They can vote in somebody who claims to be a democratic leader and in fact turns out to be a demagogue who then turns himself into a tyrant. So democracies are always, according to Plato and indeed Aristotle and other philosophers, going to be particularly vulnerable to attacks from within. But then also the more authoritarian regimes, they can get to the point where not enough people kind of sign up to them. I mean, so in Sparta, you had a very, very few Spartans trying to lord it over a massive, basically slave serf helot population. And the Helots, of course, had no invested interest in fighting for Sparta. So if you have a people on the whole who don't feel invested in the government and who don't want to die for it and don't want to fight for it, because they feel the government's not on their side and the government's corrupt, then you've also got a massive problem. We've been seeing that very, very recently in global affairs. So in different ways, both democracies and oligarchies, you know, have problems. You say, do empires not have these problems? They don't have the democratic problem, but they do have the narrative problem. So the Persian Empire never, it was, you know, it was multicultural or tried to be, and you can say that's good. Yeah, it is good, but it never formed an identifying narrative. And so once the more charismatic leaders such as Cyrus and Darius had gone, and Xerxes was quite charismatic, but he spent all the money, you know, he kept fighting wars and losing them, and he kind of denuded the coffers. And then after Xerxes, there really isn't a leader with a compelling enough personality to bind this very huge multicultural empire together. And again, it just started to factionalize, the military started to fall apart, and people just didn't want to fight. What were they fighting for? And we've heard lots of different stories today about what kind of unifying narrative whether it's an empire or a state or a nation might want to tell about itself. But without such a narrative, why do people want to die young? So,
yeah, thanks, Angie. Those are really interesting points. I mean, I think narratives are crucial. We might want to circle back to that a bit later. And
can I just have literally 20 seconds? What's really interesting, in if you look at the philosophers in ancient Greece, is that they really are nearly all critical of empires. They have different views about what the best kind of constitutional state might be, but they really don't like the notion of empires in ancient Greece. Rome is obviously different, but it seemed to be hubristic. You know, building an empire is seen to be hubristic and a challenge to the gods, and you will be struck down in the end. Rome is a different story.
Yeah, and one of the main aims of the Republic, which you talked about in your earlier talk today, is to not become an empire, to be a state that's, on some estimates, 1/6 the size of Athens, and just kind of keep it at that. So thank you for that. And James, let's skip ahead 1,500 years after the Middle Ages. You suddenly see a kind of reemergence of a very similar ecosystem to the ancient one, where, again, you have these wealthy city-states, a lot of them maritime. There aren't as many as there were in the ancient world, but they're richer, and they produced, you know, the amazing Renaissance that we all admire. So looking at that time period, when you look at, say, Florence or Venice or Genoa, and you compare those mini republics to the large kingdoms like France or Spain, do you see any unique challenges or weaknesses or internal problems in those mini republics that, again, that you don't find in the larger kingdoms?
Yes, but I think we have to go back a little before the Renaissance, because the second great age of city-state cultures in the West after Greek antiquity was the 13th century, when there are literally hundreds of communes, as they called them, that come into existence all over northern central Italy. And they are rather short-lived by comparison with the Greek city-states, which, after all, last. You can say that the Greek city-state structure lasts underneath the umbrella of empires down to the end of antiquity. But in the case of Italy, the hundreds of city-states that come into existence in the 13th century are all gone, except for five, by the middle of the 14th century. So there's this period of tremendous flourishing of city-state culture, and then boom, it's all gone. The only ones left by the mid-14th century are Florence, Siena, Venice, Lucca. What's the fifth one? Siena, Lucca.
Genoa,
yeah, but I never count Genoa because it's even more unsuccessful than Florence. You're right. Okay. So there are five majors. There are five major republics that survive by the middle of the 14th century. So why is that the case? Why do they all collapse? Well, what usually happens is that there's a lot of factionalism, lots of class conflict, and conflict even more between clientage systems, which are the ancestors of political parties. And these city-states just never developed institutions that could manage partisanship. They all had unwritten constitutions, which is a very dignified way of saying that they consisted of institutions that were put together at the last moment under emergency conditions to stave off disaster. But their political institutions were simply incompetent. There was not enough political prudence to construct institutions, with the exception of Venice. Venice is always the exception here. It's the most successful republic in the Renaissance. So that's one problem. These city-states are always descending into street warfare and exiles and so forth, and how they usually come to an end is that they bring a strong man in, a signore, who can be a general, a man with an army, but it also can be a very powerful, wealthy citizen who owns a lot of the city, like Cosimo de' Medici later on, who can impose order by manipulation of his financial power. They never really managed, these city-states of medieval Italy never really managed to create enduring institutions. I think Siena is also a possible exception. You wrote about that a bit in your latest, in your penultimate book, Neil, the great age of the nine from 1280 to 1350. That was a very stable, impressive government, but they couldn't keep it going. And the other problem was that they're living in a foreign policy environment, as we'd say today, that was constantly shifting. So you would put together a government that looked like it was stable, and then the allies of that government outside the city-state, the empire or the papacy or the House of Anjou, things would shift, and the regime would come crashing down because there's an army outside the gates which is supporting the opposite party. So it's, I think one of the lessons of the collapse of popular government in the early 14th century and the emergence of tyranny as an alternative was precisely the failure of institutions and also the sheer size of these in very, very small places. Even Florence in its great period was rather small place. When you ask why the Florentines fell to the French army, I think the simplest answer is that the entire adult male population of Florence consisted of 10,000 people, and the French army consisted of 50,000 people. They simply weren't going to win. A city-state could not defeat a regional state or a royal state in this period.
Oh, and that's that last point is really interesting. And I think that's something to be noted, that it seems that democracies and republics are harder to scale than empires. They can be scaled. I mean, Rome was the one exception that really managed to scale their republic to rival all the great empires of the time. And then, of course, it collapsed into an empire. But so that's one challenge. And then another interesting thread I'm seeing here is, you know, James, you mentioned how you have factionalism, which leads to somebody bringing in a strong man. And that was one of the highlights of Angie's talk earlier when she talked about Plato's Republic, books 8 and 9, where you get the description of how a constitutional state becomes a democracy, and then that becomes a tyranny when, you know, demagogues take over the civic infrastructure, and, you know, someone brings in a demagogue, and that becomes a tyranny, et cetera. So those are, then this further point of factionalism is interesting because I guess the ancient writers, and as you just pointed out, James, the Renaissance writers are all interested in how faction seems to be a feature, not a bug, of constitutional states. Now, as we turn to Neil and the more modern era, maybe we can flip it a bit and talk about the advantages of democracy. Neil, in your book, Doom, you quote the economist Amartya Sen, who said that you know, the kind of famines that we saw in Maoist China or in the early Soviet Union, they wouldn't have happened in a democracy because democracies have the mechanisms in place to handle that. So do you buy that? And what, from your analysis of more modern history, what do you see as some of the inherent strengths and weaknesses of constitutional states versus empires?
It's a fascinating conversation we're having, particularly with the map of the world behind you, because it's a reminder that the really odd thing about the world's political evolution is the bizarre distribution of state sizes. And if you had to explain to an alien how we run ourselves, the thing the alien would be interested in would not be which systems were representative and which were not. The alien would want to understand why more than a third of people live in just two countries with a population larger than a billion. A quarter of people live in 11 countries with populations larger than 100 million. A third of people live in 75 countries with populations more than 10 million. And everybody else, which is just 5.223% of the population, live in 144 states of varying degrees of tininess. And you would have a job explaining that with any of the kind of standard conceptual frameworks that people use when they talk about the history of politics in a Western framework. the two giants are one empire which has an entirely authoritarian system of government that pretends to be a very ancient civilization state, but actually is a really quite newly minted totalitarian system modeled on the Marxist-Leninist design. That's the People's Republic of China. The other billion plus state is a former British colony that the British turned into a unitary entity called India. And the map behind you, if you kind of did it as a political geography map, rather than the map that you have, essentially tells the story of empires and their fragmentation in the second half of the 20th century, when the huge empires that were built by Europeans and European settlers began to fall apart following the great imperial conflicts of World War I and World War II. It's all about economies of scale until it isn't. I mean, the reason, as James rightly said, that the city-states lose out to territorial monarchies, I mean, it's just economies of scale. I mean, you have this strange race around the world to exploit economies of scale and governance. And the Asians are way ahead for a long time. Because there's nothing comparable to the Chinese state in Europe after the disintegration of Rome. But it then turns out, and this is the kind of twist in the historical tale, that China's too big to innovate, and that the European state system that evolves, in which there are kind of roughly evenly matched territorial monarchies, is great for promoting two things: innovation in armaments and fiscal innovation or financial innovation more broadly. And so it's in Europe that you get the really important advances that are preludes to the Industrial Revolution that make European weapons much more destructive and effective. And at the same time, you develop public debts and systems of taxation that have nothing remotely comparable in the rest of the world. Once the Europeans have worked out how to use economies of scale in warfare and taxation and government borrowing, they just can take the rest of the world on and take it over, which they basically do. And then, having taken it over, they then fight these two hugely destructive wars that then cause the empires to dissolve. But you're left with these residues, like the Russian Empire turns out to be this indestructible thing covering a vast territory that survives incredible assaults. Like, think of Operation Barbarossa. Most states would not have survived the scale of that offensive. The Russian state proves to be very, very resilient, survives the collapse of communism, survives a kind of Weimar period in the 1990s. India holds together. It's extraordinary. I mean, the British make this huge unitary state in South Asia, and apart from Pakistan, it's basically still intact against really the odds when you think about it. You think about that. And I could go on in this vein. Indonesia, it's the Dutch Empire. Some imperial residues survive, but there's this kind of fissiparity on the periphery that produces lots and lots and lots of little states that really, really shouldn't be viable and are only viable because the big states tolerate them. And that's the world we inhabit today. It's very much the result of the ways in which European empire became entirely dominant, starting really in the 16th and 17th century and reaching the peak of their dominance in the 1930s. And then there's this kind of disintegration, but it's actually quite incomplete disintegration, which is why the map of the world looks the way it does. I'll leave it there because obviously there's a discussion to be had about these hybrid entities that I call empire states. In War of the World, I make the point that China's an empire pretending to be a nation state and homogenizing the population ruthlessly so that they all start to believe that they're Han Chinese. And if you're not, you might as well give up. So you have these hybrids that emerge in the 20th century that are really empire-sized, but nation-state structured in the terms of their homogeneity. You asked a question about the sort of advantages of democracy. There's no real advantage to democracy in itself. That's the kind of dirty little secret revealed in the book Civilization. The advantages in rule of law, the advantages in having property rights that are actually meaningful. Having elections is kind of luxury product the thing that matters is whether you have meaningful competition, economic and political competition, and some kind of rule of law, and then institutions that can promote science. And if you have those things, it doesn't really matter how you select the people who run the country, whether it's through some kind of competitive examination or elections. That's not crucial.
Wow, thanks, Neil. And, you know, I probably have 10 questions I'd like to ask you, but I saw Angie raise her hand a while back, actually. So, Angie, I want you to jump in, and then I also saw James later. So, Angie, take it away.
Oh, Neil, it's so good to see you again. I wish we were debating this over a real bottle of something for real. I've missed Neil, we go back a very long way. Our views do not always cohere, but we always have really enjoyable and civilized discussions, and that is what is so important. Right, so the philosophic basis to me of democracy comes from the 17th century. It comes from the notion that of each individual matters and has a right to a voice. It doesn't come, happily for us, in the notion that the majority are always right. They clearly aren't. Otherwise, slavery would have been right all the many hundreds of years when the majority of people were okay with it. It doesn't mean that the majority are always factually correct, or the world would have been flat when the majority of people thought that was the case. So that, happily for us, is not the philosophic basis to argue for democracy, that the majority is right. No, it's about the importance that each individual has the right to have their voice heard. So I'm trying to remember which liberal, you all know this, is it Captain Rainsborough in the 17th century who says the poorest he that is in this country have a life to live as much as the greatest he. Is that Colonel Rainsborough? Anyway, what to do with the levelers movement.
That so, is familiar, but I'm not going to say yes or no.
So I think for all the many problems with democracy, and you know, we've been seeing them hugely in the last few years, or it seems to me, I think you can say that democracies can make terrible mistakes, but that there is still a genuine human rights issue at the basis of it, which underpins the system, even when the system is working very badly. So I would want to me, it's still the least bad system that's been invented so far. But
thank you, Angie. I want to jump to James. Just a logistical question. So we're 10 minutes from the hour. Do any of you have to run on the dot, or can we go a little bit over time? Because I think we have some interesting stuff that needs to be
explored. Sadly, I have some children to collect from play dates. I don't have a ton of wiggle room. Okay. But I mean,
I can wiggle a bit. It's so late here. I'm in the UK. It's so late anyway.
I'm fine. You know.
It's irrelevant, really.
So, James, I'm eager to hear your thoughts on the matter, and then we'll go back to Neil.
Right. Well, I wanted to disagree a bit with Neil also. I don't think it's just the rule of law, or that's the main thing even. I've been reading Ibn Khaldun, oddly enough, and he has this concept of asabiyya, which is social solidarity. And I think that democracy is certainly one way to get social solidarity. But this is something actually Machiavelli was very wise about. He understood what he thought the Romans were good at was social solidarity. And the reason why is because they had a plebeian class that stood up on its hind legs and said, we're not going to take it from the patricians. You know, you want us to go to war? Give us something. Give us a tribune of the people. Give us a consul. And what Machiavelli saw was that conflict, the kind of conflict that occurs in democratic societies, but also can occur in republican societies, can be a source of social solidarity, in that people who fight for their position in the political system, and they can be people on the bottom who are fighting for their position in the political system, those people, once they have won something and are then participating in a fuller way in the political system, they make a very powerful state, right? They create the asabiyya, right? Because they feel that they're not simply a subordinate class of servants to the elite, but they are themselves have a voice within the government. And this is what really Machiavelli's message is in the Discorsi, that that's what we're lacking in Renaissance republics. We have dominant elites, we have financial elites who are controlling everything, and then the poor or the middle classes, even the little people, do not have a voice. But in the Roman state, the little people had a voice. They had their tribunes. They had voices in election. They were consulted by assemblies, and that's what made Rome great. Because after all, Rome's empire was built by its republic, right? Most of the Roman Empire was created under the Roman Republic. And so Machiavelli's explanation for that is the social solidarity that comes from widespread political participation. And again, it doesn't have to be democracy. In fact, modern democracy for me is kind of fake democracy. But it there has to be some kind of sense that people are at least represented or and feel that their own will has some kind of control, that the system represents them in some way.
Thank you, James. And I think it's just a small piece of what you're saying involves this classic distinction between the modern notion of freedom and the classical notion of freedom. The classical notion of freedom is kind of what you were just saying, how you feel that you have a say in where the ship of state is going. And the modern notion of freedom is that you have your own cabin on that ship and you can do whatever you want in the cabin and nobody can bother you, but you have no say in where the ship is going. So there's one final topic I want to, the last topic or chapter of the discussion that I wanted to get to is the lessons from history. And I think most non-historians are shocked when they discover that most professional historians do not look for lessons in history, but we are fortunate here to have three of the very few in the world who actually do look for lessons in history. And so Neil, since you will have to leave us soon, I want to get your thoughts before you go. What is, and several people have been writing in the comments as we've been talking about the recent events we've been seeing on our television screens, the collapse of Afghanistan, the withdrawal of American troops, all that stuff. And so a lot of people are asking, you know, what is the biggest lesson you'd say from your book or your recent research about how a state like America could, you know, not collapse and could actually deal with catastrophes in a resilient manner and survive?
Well, let me try and get some continuity from the last exchanges, because it's important to do that. What Angie did was quote Churchill's famous quip that democracy was the worst of all systems apart from all the others that have been tried from time to time. And I don't disagree with that. When I was trying to answer the question in civilization, why the West had become entirely dominant over the rest, really until the end of the 20th century, after which things began to change, it became clear to me that you couldn't explain that with respect to democracy, because all the kind of big advances in Western dominance predate universal suffrage, unless you're using democracy in a looser sense to mean just representative government. But the kind of representation that let's say Britain had as it rapidly expanded its global power was very restrictive. And it's clear when you look at what makes Britain powerful that, yeah, the representative part's important, but it's important precisely because it's not democratic. It's the propertied elite who are represented in the Houses of Parliament. And that representation after the Glorious Revolution gives them significant checks on the power of the what we would call in the US the executive branch, i.e. the crown. And the other crucial thing is that the courts have a distinct autonomy too from the crown, especially after judges are appointed for life. And so what turned out to really matter in Britain was not democracy, because the vote was, the franchise was very restricted, but the fact that you had a representative system in which property owners were highly protected, both through political representation and through the rule of law. And that meant that capital accumulation just races forward. Highly regressive tax system. It's all indirect taxation. It's corrupt by modern standards because they basically treat government offices as things that they can dish out to their cronies. But it's an incredibly powerful system. It completely destroys the competition. The French can't come close because the British state is so good at running a public debt that it can build a fucking huge navy that's far larger than the French navy and win every time there's a real showdown. So I have to say that when I think about the historical question, why does the West become so dominant? Democracy seems like something the West does after it has achieved total dominance. And then it can give the hyperloi votes. But that's really after the dominance has been achieved. Asabiya, I'm so glad you mentioned it, Jim, because it was in the chat. And I actually keep an eye on the chat. And it was something that I was really glad you mentioned, not least because it gives me a chance to plug Peter Turchin's work. Now, I don't know if anybody else keeps track of Peter, but I really like cloudynamics as an attempt to kind of do a more quantitative and I would say natural science-based kind of history. I'm not sure I buy the cyclical theory that he's ended up with, but I do like the fact that in his early work, he used Asabiya as a concept for understanding why certain states become successful. And that, of course, is why Turchin thinks the US is in such trouble, because in his model, that's gone. And we've lost the sense of community that previously the United States did have. If one thinks of its glory days in the mid-20th century, we talk endlessly about polarization in American political discourse. But what really illustrates the danger of polarization is when issues of public health become partisan talking points, and when it becomes a partisan issue to be for or against vaccination. If that doesn't illustrate a fundamental breakdown of Khaldun's notion of Asabiya, I don't know what does. And that suggests to me that, and this gets to your question, Jack, that the United States is in a very dangerous state of fragmentation. I just published an article for The Economist, and in the article I make a point that I think you will agree with, Jim, maybe Angie won't. The argument is that the British Empire in the mid-20th century was assailed not only by excessive debt, the cost of World War I, but also by excessive doubt. The people stopped believing in it. The elites became either communists or Nazi supporters. And there was a sort of Daily Express mockery of the empire, which you would see in the Beachcomber column. And the US is in this exact situation today where it's incredibly indebted. The public finances of the United States are just a horrific mess, that it has only got worse since I wrote Colossus. But what really is alarming, because it's of more recent origin, is this deep, deep polarization, which seems to me to have no obvious sort of self-correcting point. If one thinks about the way all the universities, just about without exception, have ended up on one side of the political divide, and the universities have become places where you actually can't have the kind of free discussion we would associate with academic life, you realize that in some ways that the institutional foundations of American power are in a really very, very unhealthy state. And that's why Americans can stumble into a fiasco like the evacuation of Kabul, because there's been a kind of breakdown in the political process. Harold James, I'll say one more thing. Harold James made a great point in an essay last year. He said, this is the late Soviet period of American history. And I think Joe Biden's performance over the last week has perfectly illustrated that analogy.
Well, Neil, I'm glad that you mentioned polarization, because this is another topic that goes back to both the Italian Renaissance and the late Italian Middle Ages, and also Greco-Roman antiquity. And I think it's something that's unique to democracies and republics. I mean, empires can have religious divides. They can have vicious divides among the fans of different chariot teams, like in the Byzantine Empire. But it's different when you have, you know, a civic infrastructure of, you know, discourse and debate and the election or appointing of office, which can be hijacked by, you know, demagogues who can create basically two movies where two halves of the population see totally different realities. That, you know, America has been phenomenally lucky to have gone on for over two centuries without seeing that very often. But the Italians, they saw it and they saw the consequences of that. The ancient Greeks saw it and they saw the consequences of that. We still have not seen the end of what that would be like. So I want to take it back to maybe James. And you know, this term, yeah, this term of Asabiya, the Arabic term that Ibn Khaldun mentions, like this kind of harmony, this magical glue. It's a great descriptive term, but it leaves open the question of how do you actually achieve that? How do you maintain that? It's almost like a ghost in the machine or a je ne sais quoi factor that makes everything run smoothly. But you've actually written in your book, Virtue Politics, about the Italian ideas of how you can create a harmonious and good state. So maybe turning to you, yeah, now, what's one of the great lessons that you think the Italian humanists can offer to our time?
Well, I want to say I agree entirely with Niels about the dangerous moment that we're in. And it's very strange to me that the two most powerful countries in the world, the US and China, have been taken over by zombie Marxism. You know, the Chinese were developing away from that in the first decade of the 21st century. And then suddenly the last 5-6 years, they've decided to become Marxist again and legalist, and sort of extreme legalist going back to the Qin dynasty. And then in the US, we have this kind of zombie Marxism that's taken over all of the major institutions in society. But I think that the problem that we've got is that we have, it's been called the successor ideology. That's one of the terms for what's taken over woke. I call it the expurge facti, or the woke element in study. So I don't know what the exit from this is. We have had occasions when the ideological unity of the civilization has broken up before, and the most famous one is the Protestant Reformation, right? That there was the ideological unity of medieval, with all of its fissures and pressures and cross, the fighting back and forth between emperor and pope, there was still a fundamental unity about doctrine in the Middle Ages, and this breaks up in the Reformation. And then we have a century and a half of religious warfare, and I hope that's not what we have ahead. Warfare between the two religions of our time in America. And I don't mean Christianity, Marxism, I mean the old American traditional. I think Christopher Caldwell's written very well about the kind of shift in constitutional commitments of Americans between the 1960s and the present time. There is a major ideological shift, and the elite are way out in front. Although I dislike the language of front and back, right, of progress and regress. But the elite are certainly have very different ideas from what non-elite citizens have. This has been discussed by Charles Murray in his very brilliant book of several years ago. Now I'm having difficulty remembering the name.
The book Coming Apart, which
really anatomizes the difference between elite and non-elite Americans very effectively. So we have to do something about that. And I think what this calls for is reform of elites in some way. We have to, something like what the Renaissance did. In fact, the Renaissance was, well, in my view, the Renaissance is essentially about the reform of elites, that the humanities are invented. They supersede the liberal arts. They were invented in the middle of the 14th century precisely to reform elites and to restore them to create a common civilization again. So I will stop because there are many people with questions.
Thank you, Jim. And I want to get back to you and press the point again. I want some nugget of applicable, actionable advice from the Renaissance. But before we get there, and Angie, I want to get to you as well. But Neil, you need to bounce. So I want to just give you the mic one last time and throw a question at you from the audience, which is, once a civilization goes down the path of decline, is there any turning back? Is there any way to resuscitate, revive, rejuvenate, or is it basically just a delay tactic, try to prolong the inevitable?
Well, I think there is. I mean, that the good news is that there isn't a cycle of history that drives you inexorably downhill, because actually polities are not like human beings. They don't just kind of age naturally and die. I think one of the things that I've learned over the last 20 years of thinking about this problem is that that in fact we should allow the possibility that especially a democracy can self-repair. And Jim's just illustrated that the ways that self-repair can work in earlier times too. He might have said that when the Reformation appeared to have rendered Europe completely a charnel house by the 1640s, that there was a self-repair first with the Peace of Westphalia. And then between them, the Scientific Revolution and the Enlightenment created a new kind of framework within which at least the elites could share common values as they had in the Renaissance. So I'm not a pessimist or a fatalist in the sense that I think the US goes through periods of division and self-harm. That's precisely why we think back to 1975 in Saigon when we look at images of Kabul. Well, let's not forget that there were plenty of people who thought the United States was on the skids in 1975, and they turned out to be completely wrong. To just conclude by bringing us back to where we started, the Toynbee issue. The United States has all kinds of profound internal divisions, but in the short run, the biggest risk that it faces is the threat from China. And the Chinese don't have much time to execute their bid for world power because their demography and their debt dynamics are all against them. So there's a window of extreme danger approaching. This was the argument I made in The Economist this week, where the Chinese have to make their move on Taiwan, and which clearly Xi Jinping has staked his prestige. And we will see at that point whether the United States can kind of recover its asabiya, or whether it actually is going to fold like other empires have folded in the past in the face of a challenge from, you know, an authoritarian rival empire. And in that sense, it's been a very worthwhile exercise to engage in the sharing of classical and modern wisdom, because this is an old story, as Graham Allison argued. You might disagree with Graham's reading of the Thucydides trap, but it's fundamentally the right question that he's asking. How does the free society, the empire based on liberty, deal with the rise of a new empire that is profoundly hostile, explicitly hostile to individual liberty? That is the big question. And it's going to be decided, I think, within 5 years.
Great. Thanks,
with that,
Neil.
I'm going to have to go and be dad rather prosaically. But let me take this opportunity to thank you, Jack, for doing a great job of moderating this. Thank my former colleagues and friends for a fantastic discussion, which actually has put me in a very good mood for doing a child chauffeuring. And I'd also like to thank all the participants. There were a bunch of very interesting questions in the chat, and I kept an eye on that while we were talking. So thanks, everybody. This has been a lot of fun.
Great to see you, Neil.
Thank you, Neil. So Angie, I'm dying to hear your thoughts on, I mean, again, kind of, is there a lesson, some actionable lesson, some nugget of wisdom from Plato or Aristotle or any of the thinkers that you spend your days examining closely? Is there some kind of idea there or actionable advice that we would be, that would be worthwhile popularizing again and trying to implement?
Okay, I think, yeah, three takeaways, I think, from the ancient writers that I study. I mean, the one, unfashionable language, but apart from a few exceptions, such as Pompeii, such as Thera, a few environmental catastrophes, a few wars, but on the whole, the things that bring down and either deeply damage or destroy states and empires nearly always have a very strong bunch of moral components. And it's very unfashionable to use the language of morality, but if you look into the history of why states, nations, empires decline, and in some cases are extinguished, there is nearly always greed, corruption, mendacity, incompetence, moral, intellectual laziness, and so on, and a big bunch at middle managers and in leaders. And you end up with huge numbers of the citizens or the subjects who just are not prepared to fight for this empire or this state or this nation, or don't care enough about it to work for its survival, because what is it to them? And as we're seeing today, you know, even as I've said earlier, you know, even our vulnerability to certain wars, to certain environmental catastrophes, not always, but very often there's a moral component. So that's the first takeaway. Unfashionable, but, you know, morality matters. The second one is how we really need to rethink our relationship with uncertainty. Because of modern technology, I think we've sort of fallen under an illusion that we are in control and we are masters of our fate. And yet, you know, Neil was saying this earlier in his talk, it's extraordinary the number of connections between our experience of the pandemic, at least early on, and what the ancient Athenians went through in 430, or what the Florentines went through. When was it, James? Was it the 1490s? There was I remember Ficino wrote a book on pestilence, didn't he? So no matter how moral, so yes, we need to be more virtuous and not be afraid to talk about individual and communal virtues, but also we need to accept that no, you know, and this is of course one of the morals of Plato's legend of Atlantis in the Timaeus and Critias, that virtue will help you against in all sorts of human situations, but there are still going to be environmental and disease disasters that are going to strike. And we cannot have complete certainty. So we then also need to develop the kinds of virtues and intellectual capacities and competency capacities that help us be strong and flexible and agile in the face of this uncertainty and these sudden catastrophes, and help us rebuild. And where Plato is so interesting is he doesn't just talk about the decline of states and empires and the Republic and the Timaeus and the Critias. He also talks about how to rebuild after cyclical cataclysms in the Politicus, the statesman and the laws and so on. And I think that's really important. So a little bit less arrogance and acceptance of some of the fragility and uncertainty of human life and developing the kinds of moral and intellectual capacities to deal with that. And the third thing is picking up what you have been talking about with James and Neil, which is republics, democracies can survive, indeed thrive on a lot of diversity of opinion. And it's needed. These kinds of debates are needed, or, you know, as John Stuart Mill said, you know, even correct beliefs become dogma, ossify into dogma, if you don't debate them, if they're not challenged, if they're not scrutinized. So yes, diversity of opinion is absolutely fundamental to a flourishing democracy or republic. But, and this is what you were talking about, when diversity of opinion and civilized debate tips over into dogmatic polarization and the kind of belief that somebody who votes differently from you is evil in all respects, that they can't survive. And my worry is that how do we deal with social media? How can republics and democracies survive social media and the proliferation of echo chambers and very simplistic debates and very simplistic views of our fellow humans and fellow citizens, and an unwillingness to sort of think, well, there must be something we've got in common, even if it's only a taste for a certain kind of Assyrtiko wine or whatever. So and that really worries me. That really worries me.
Thank you, Angie. Those are three really fascinating points. And, you know, to wrap up, James, I'm going to throw the last question at you, and then we'll call it a day. This has been a really fascinating conversation so far. I'm so grateful to have been a part of it. So James, you are an educator. You've been teaching at Harvard for many, many years. You are bringing the Renaissance humanism to modern students, and you've written a book about how humanism was invented for some kind of public good. So can you leave us with some, you know, some lesson or objective, or like, what's the value of the texts that you've been studying for so long, and, you know, what can we get from them?
Oddly enough, the Rory Stewart just wrote a long diatribe on the in the first page of TLS this week, where he actually cites my book rather nicely. I wrote an article a couple of weeks ago called "How to Build Your Own Renaissance." It's on public discourse, and I'm arguing that if we're in a bad state now, and we have a lot of conflict that's not simply disagreement about ends, but it's disagreement about ends and means. It's disagreement about, we can't even agree about what to disagree on. So we have incommensurable worldviews. And I think what we need to do is to rebuild, as the Renaissance did, a common culture. And the Renaissance, of course, they looked to classical antiquity. They were convinced that the Greeks and the Romans had something that were missing in the modern world. And that always sounds a bit idealistic, but when you think about the 14th century Italy, it was truly a horrendous place to live. And tyranny was actually tyrannous. You know, most of the torture inventions of medieval Europe were invented in 14th century Italy. There was a tremendous amount of public cruelty and violence. And the rulers were people who were rather openly out for themselves and the people around them and not caring about the common good at all. And so what Petrarch, who's the real founder of the humanist movement, saw was that we needed to change the human heart. And that had to happen through education. And so this is what the humanities were about for the first 150 years, was changing the human heart, getting people to look back to antiquity, not in some kind of starry-eyed way, but just look to see that the ancients had an idea. They had ideas of nobility, which were missing in their society. They had ideas of public, of service. The Romans believed, you know, with all their faults, and the Romans could be cruel and horrible also, but the Romans did have an idea of public service. And status based on public service. And all these things were missing in the society of 14th century Italy, and they thought that education would bring them back. So my closing remark, I guess, would be that we should recommit ourselves to an education that's not taught as a luxury good, right? It's not something that you can, you teach it as an entertainment for its entertainment value, after you've done with the real education, which is getting people a good job out of college. We should teach our humanities classes as a chance to mold people to have real sense of public duty and to form a society with common cultural values. I'm not saying that diversity doesn't count. Diversity does count, but there has to be a bedrock set of values that everybody shares. And this is what the classical culture was meant to do in the Renaissance, that it wasn't, since it was so long ago, it could in a way be a shared culture in the way that, you know, whether you were loyal to the Pope or the Emperor or your local political party could not be. All those loyalties were present and they were divisive, but there was the common possession of antiquity, which all the Italians felt in the Renaissance, could be a kind of basis for a mutual understanding. And I guess I'm preaching to the converted here on this particular website, but I deeply believe that the classics do provide a common culture, a common set of reference points. It's not a dogma, obviously, but there are certain common beliefs that the ancients believed, one of which, I think maybe the most important of which, is that the person who can't control, who cannot rule himself, cannot rule others.
Very nicely said. And since you touched on a lot of the points that, Angie, you made from your earlier talk, I just want to give the opportunity, any final quick thoughts before we call it a day? The floor is yours.
Yes, well, James, don't come and live in the UK at the moment. If the person, people who can't rule themselves shouldn't rule others. I completely agree. I mean, to me, classics, it's not just so important that it gets us to think about our common humanity and how to live a flourishing life as individuals and as communities. It's also a way, as I think we've finding out this weekend, one can explore really quite deep ethical and religious differences in a way that people feel less threatened by. Because at the time that we're writing, the philosophers that I discuss in the BC philosophers I discuss, they're not writing at a time of Christianity, obviously, the BCE ones. They're not writing at a time of Islam. There is Judaism, but the philosophers I discuss on the whole until quite later on are not Judaic. You can really get quite deeply into some difficult areas, and the people you're discussing with don't feel so threatened. They don't feel their own identity as being immediately threatened. And I have found going around schools all around the country, going to universities, you can get into very, very tough areas, but people feel more relaxed. It's a wonderful, wonderful shared resource that we have, which can bring us together, even if our views are very different about a lot of things. I'm not talking about homogeneity at all, but there is a shared belief in common humanity and this common cultural heritage, which belongs to all of us, of all religions, of all colours, of all genders. It belongs to the world, and it's a wonderful way to get people talking without feeling that their own immediate religious or political allegiance is being threatened.
Beautifully said. Thank you, Angie Hobbs, and thank you, James Hankins, and thanks, Neil Ferguson, who left just recently. That's it for today. I hope you had as much fun on this first day of the Classical Symposium 2021 as I did. It's been a real blast. It's been a pleasure moderating this conversation. I enjoyed looking at the comments from the audience, so thank you for submitting those. I'm going to pass it back to Anya, the organizer. Anya, thanks again for organizing this. Back to you.
I want to say just again, thank you, Jack, for doing an excellent job for moderating the conversation, and Angie and Jim and Niall. It was absolutely fantastic. I was just enjoying myself so much just watching you guys. The conversation was thrilling. We're all sitting on the edge of our seats looking at the comments. So, what I really love the takeaway is that the importance of studying the ancient world is just so invaluable right now. It can really help us understand where we are. It can help us bridge gaps. It can help us have the conversations. And that's really the goal of classical wisdom, is to show how important the ancient world is to us today. And I really appreciate everybody being here tonight. And I think it was just an absolutely thrilling day from Edith Hall right up to the end. So I want to thank everybody who joined us, the speakers, the audience, and just to let you know, tomorrow we also have a really exciting day as well. And we have another panel also that's more philosophy-based. We've got a whole star appearance of Stoics. We'll be discussing on do we have any control over the fall of empires, and how do we handle it, and how can we prepare for it? So I want to invite everybody back tomorrow, and thank you again for joining us today. So it's been wonderful.